And turn in your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 25 as we continue our series of study through the book of Leviticus. As I approach this, the presenting problem that Leviticus 25 brings is the problem of poverty. And as I began studying this passage, that was really the big thing on my mind, is what do we do about the poor? When the Apostle Paul met to compare notes with the other apostles in Jerusalem, he reported in his epistle to the Galatians that Peter and James and John gave him the right hand of fellowship as a fellow preacher of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and then they exhorted him to remember the poor. And so throughout his ministry, as he traveled throughout the Roman Empire starting churches, he would collect charitable donations to send back to Christians in Jerusalem. Now, if we take our cues about what to do about poverty from the dominant political parties of our day, we'll find, on the one hand, a theory that's held by the majority of the younger generation in our country, that a strong, secular, central government should level out the incomes of Americans by taxing businesses and wealthy people and distributing that money freely among the poor. And popular among that ideology is the theory that debt is wealth, or debt creates wealth. So the more money that a person or a country can get in loans, the better off they will be. On the other hand, there's a competing theory held by a slim majority of the older generations in our country, that government should be decentralized, localized, and should not intervene in people's economic affairs, and that everybody should mind their own business, pretty much. And popular among that crowd is the theory that money is wealth. So the more money a person or a nation has, the better off they are. When presented with these extremes of Marxism, socialism, and libertarian capitalism, it's easy to throw up our hands and give up on politics, because we've tried both extremes, and they didn't work to solve the problem of poverty. The fabulous capitalistic industrial age of our nation in the 1800s only widened the gap between rich and poor. And then the last century of our nation, characterized to a great extent by the war on poverty, as it was called, using wealth redistribution through government programs, has continued to see only an increase of the percentage of poor people in our population. Neither has worked. If we look at church history, we see American Christianity swings back and forth over time between conservatism and liberalism in regards to biblical accuracy and theology. And it's often been the liberal side that has carried the concern for the poor most passionately. On the other hand, it seems like churches like ours, which have been formed out of a renewed commitment to biblical accuracy, tend to downplay the vision of helping the poor, because there's a lot of effort that has to be put out to do theological reform. It's natural and is not necessarily a problem if it's fit into the larger picture of the church and balance grows. In Leviticus 25, God gives us a challenge to think further about this whole issue and stretch our wings, as it were, in the area of addressing the problem of poverty. And now, one thing that I will mention here is Leviticus 25 is only one chapter out of the Bible, so it doesn't deal with every economic issue and doesn't give us every biblical tool for dealing with poverty, but it does begin to give us a handle on things. Also, Leviticus 25 delineates a particular economy that's not necessarily applicable at all points to all economies. So we're not talking about just wholesale lifting Leviticus 25 and dropping it into today's economy without any adjustment. But the economy described in Leviticus 25 was designed by God. And so because God is just and righteous, the system he designed should be a model of justice and righteousness, economic justice, in its application. Therefore, it's worth examining. What did the system look like? How does it show forth what justice and righteousness looks like in an economy? And what can we learn from that and apply to our economy? In Leviticus 25, we see capitalism, strong emphasis on land ownership, private ownership of means of production. That's capitalism. That's Leviticus 25. But it's not libertarian and it's not secular in nature. It's grounded in responsibility to God, not technically ownership, but stewardship of property owned by God and limited by God's laws against evil. At the same time, we see in Leviticus 25, wealth redistribution. Strong emphasis on handouts to the poor. Yet again, it's grounded not in an obligation to the poor or to mankind, but rather it's grounded in the character of God and in gratitude to God for what he has done, and it's limited by the strength of personal relationships. And I'll get into what I mean by that as we go on. I would like to focus on three principles that I believe have enduring economic value in our economy that I see in Leviticus 25 that I think we can use in our lives today. I think I'm only going to be able to cover about half of what I see in Leviticus 25 today, so I'm going to save a bunch of things for next week. And if you have any questions that come up as we study through this right now, feel free to text me or email me, and I'll try to bring them up in next week's sermon too. But the first concept that I see here is that of an economic reset, and that is part of the Jubilee cycle. Second concept is that of redemption of lost means of production, or redemption of lost persons. And then the third concept is that of retaining people who don't have economic self-sufficiency, and that retaining them through charity. And I tried to make them all start with the letters R and E. So reset, redeem, retain are my the 3 points that I want to cover today as I see them in Leviticus 25. And let's consider how we can apply these today in our lives and culture. The first is the reset. The year of Jubilee, I introduced that last week as we started getting into Leviticus 25. The year of Jubilee was like an economic reset button. Punch the button and everything goes back to where it started. In verse 28, anyone who sold his land to be used by another person and who never made enough money to buy his land back got to get his land back for free every 50 years. All he had to do was go claim it and settle on that land again, work it again. In verse 41, every person among God's people who sold himself as a slave was released from slavery in the 50th year and was reinstated to his forefather's property and made a property owner again. There are some natural principles behind this. Some people are better at production and management than others. Some people are better at making money than others of us. I mean, we can look around us and see that's just the case. It's just natural. It's the way God made us. We're not all equal in our ability to produce or manage or make money. There are people that are just better gifted to be able to manage more. In the Israelite economy, with a very limited amount of land, these natural differences among people and their giftings would result in some families getting very large land holdings and others living in continuous destitution if just the natural tendencies of their gifts were not checked in some way. This is one of the reasons why our nation has passed laws against monopolies. We haven't achieved all the ideals of this economy that God designed, but there's a step. limiting the bad effects of an unchecked growth in ownership of property by those most skilled to manage it. Matthew Henry wrote in his commentary on this that none should grow exorbitantly rich by laying house to house and field to field, quoting Isaiah 5, but should rather apply themselves to the cultivating of what they had than the enlarging of their possessions. And he mentions a similar concept in the ancient Roman commonwealth, that no one should be allowed to have over 500 acres. And the goal is no family should be sunk and ruined and condemned to perpetual poverty. Viewed from another angle, the Jubilee cycle acted like a kind of a debt ceiling. We talk a lot about debt ceilings in our, or at least have been talking a bit about it in the last few years in our federal government. In this system that God designed, nobody was allowed to go into debt more than 49 years' wages, because there's that economic reset every 50th year. And so you don't extend more than 49 years' worth of wages. So if you make 50 grand a year, you couldn't get a line of credit for more than $2.5 million. Contemporary financial institutions, banks, lending agencies have limits that they will apply to the amount of money they'll lend to you. But it seems that when it comes to our federal government, almost no such limits are applied. God gives us in the Jubilee principle a common sense way to keep an economy from the threat of meltdown due to unrecoverable debt. Another modern application of Jubilee is the concept of bankruptcy. Our laws allow someone who has failed financially to push the reset button. There are certain penalties that they receive as a result, but they're cleared of unpayable debts and allowed to start over again with life. And there has to be provision for this in any economic system. There's got to be a way for people who have failed to get reset. Now, there are those who are going to make an honest effort at business and fail at honest effort in business, and then there's always going to be the crooks out there that are dishonest and use bankruptcy provision in ways that basically amount to theft, because they're purposefully wasting money in their failures. But by applying this economic reset to every citizen in the economy, God's Jubilee system avoided some of these problems. For now, none of us are involved in federal level government, and there's much of this is probably not something we can do anything about. We can hold these ideals, we can teach them to our children, and maybe someday, you know, it will filter into the culture of our nation. But for now, we can apply this in personal relationships. If there's anyone who's indebted to you, you have an option of pushing the reset button with them and saying, your debt is canceled. You can start over again. If we have any relationships where someone else owes us something and we realize they're not going to be able to pay it back, this is a biblical tool for approaching poverty. A second tool is that of redemption. The situations described in verses 25 and following, as well as in verses 47 and following, are desperate situations that require intervention. There are people in a very desperate situation. In verses 25 and following, you have a farmer or even someone in the suburbs who has a garden that's described in verse 31. And they become so poor that they're selling off their agricultural land in order to buy food. What happens next? Well, now he doesn't even have ground to plant seeds and grow crops on, so he's going to have even less food, even less money. He's in a downward spiral at this point. It's not going to be economically sustainable. He needs intervention, like the taxi driver who has to sell his taxi cab in order to pay rent that month. Now he sold his car, he can't make any more income. Next month's going to be even worse. He's at a dead end financially. He needs intervention. So here's a second God-given principle for dealing with poverty. Privately redeeming means of production for a particular poor person in order to get them back to the ability to provide for themselves. At the beginning of verse 25, it's a singular you, you personally. And it's the same person as the kinsman redeemer, the near relative. And the relationship between this person and the poor man is described in the Hebrew language as that of a brother. Some of your translations say fellow man or something like that. And in Hebrew, it's the word brother. Some translated as relative. And that's consistent with the wider use of the word in Hebrew. That brother has a range of meaning that includes in its figurative extensions of meaning, relatives and friends. If your own blood brother or sister or your parents become so poor that they have to start selling their own means of generating income in order to keep body and soul together, then you should certainly step in and help. Your immediate family members, God expects you to help your immediate family members. Your obligation to step in and help can also apply to other people outside your immediate family. But there are limits to what God has enabled you to do. I can't help but appreciate the efforts of Bill Gates and Bono and George Bush attempting to alleviate all policy and all poverty in Africa. But our responsibility does not extend to every person in the whole world. The Hebrew here literally says, his Redeemer who is near to him. There's some relational nearness that's involved in the obligation to help. Not every mendicant that you see on the side of the road do you have an obligation to help. You know, if you can and want to and are equipped to, great. But not everyone is your responsibility. But there are people near you that God says you carry an obligation for. Now, it may be that this term redeemer, I think we're still at verse 25, it may be a predetermined role like that of a godfather, or it may not have been predetermined, but just taken on as a role by someone who at the time realized God has put them in a position to help. I think of Boaz, who was not the designated next of kin who's responsible for Ruth and Naomi. But Boaz realized, I'm in a position to help. And so he took on that role of the Redeemer, and he took initiative to grab that role and fulfill it. He had to get permission from the other relative first. In the New Testament, who is our brother, and where do those obligations lie? We certainly see the term brother and sister applied to fellow church members, fellow Christians. I think it's a clear way to apply this verse in principle now is when you see a family member or a fellow Christian going under financially, and you see that God has given you the means to help them recover some of their stuff, you should accept the role of Redeemer for them and take the initiative to go and redeem. A small illustration of this in my life that I can think of, I was working with a mission agency in Denver, recruiting foreign missionaries at that point. And I would meet periodically with a mission pastor in downtown Denver. And one day while I was waiting for him at the church building, I fell into conversation with some janitors at the building and discovered these guys were musicians. And so we quickly got excited about music that we were composing and recording and talked about that as I was waiting on meeting with the pastor. But these guys were a bit messy. I think one of them was an ex-convict, and they were clearly hard up for money. And at one point, one of them said, "Yeah, man, I had the 16-channel mixer, but I had to pawn it in order to get enough money to pay for groceries." I happened to be in charge of setting up the sound system for a retreat following weekend, and I had a budget to rent equipment for the job. So I researched it a little bit and found out that getting his mixer out of hock would be about the same amount of money as renting a mixer. So I did that. I used my budget to get his mixer out of the pawn shop, used it for my retreat, and then handed it off to him. It's a small example of a redeeming means of production. Because we're not in the same kind of the agricultural economy that was in the beginning years of Israel. But there are other means of production that we can redeem in our modern economy, like maybe a music mixer. Verse 26 describes a situation where there is no kinsman redeemer. Nobody steps up to help. The poor person himself keeps plugging away whatever work he can do, and God blesses him with the means to buy back his field or his taxi cab or his business, whatever. This should be a reminder that sometimes God doesn't see fit to give you a free ride. If you're crashing and you think, "God, I need help here. I deserve help here. Why isn't anybody helping me?" It's really easy to start feeling bitterness. Why didn't my brother step in and hear? My brother makes more money than I do. Why didn't this other family in the church help me? I needed help. They didn't step up. And that bitterness can easily set in. But sometimes God wants us to experience the grind of poverty and hard work in order to develop our relationship with him in some way. Don't let bitterness and resentment creep in if no rich uncle sleeps in to relieve your uncomfortable situation. Work plus time plus trust in God may be God's means for your redemption. Later on in verses 47 and following, the same principle of redemption is applied not only to property but also to persons. If someone is in such a desperate situation that they have to sell themselves into slavery, then somebody, preferably a relative, preferably one of their own siblings, was to buy him or her back. And verse 53 seems to indicate a moral responsibility even for us to look out for our brothers and sisters in case their master or their employer is mistreating them. Some employers take advantage of their employees. And sometimes it takes a brother or sister to say, hey, your employer is not treating you fairly. If he doesn't shape up, I'm going to get him in trouble. Or I'll get you out of that abusive situation. We've had to do that in a couple situations with our own son's employment. When our sons were young, didn't realize employers were doing things that really, if they got to court, would be considered illegal. It's a lot easier for unscrupulous employers to take advantage of vulnerable people. So we need to hold those employers accountable to biblical standards of fairness. Now, since slavery is illegal here, much of this passage may seem irrelevant, but Proverbs tells us that debt is a form of slavery. And debt is something we've got a lot of around here. We could apply this passage today by saying that if a family member was having to go into debt to make ends meet, and you had the means to help them out of debt, then you should redeem them out of that bondage of debt. And another example from my own life, before we were married, my wife and I entered college expecting to become engineers, so we figured we could afford to go into a good bit of debt for tuition at a private Christian college, because we were going to be making good money when we got out as engineers. My wife's parents even warned her, don't marry a missionary or a pastor if you go to a Christian college. And when we started courting, I was not going to be a missionary or a pastor. I was going to be an electrical engineer. But God changed all that, and I became a missionary after all. And then the first mission organization I joined had a fiasco that left me and my wife extremely vulnerable financially. We were liable for huge amounts of college loans, but we couldn't even afford to pay rent. So we moved out of our apartment, and that's when our parents stepped in, as well as an uncle, and became kinsmen redeemers very literally for us. They put us up in their homes for about a year so that we wouldn't have to pay for rent, and I think they paid for a lot of groceries too. During that time, I was able to concentrate on rebuilding, getting set up in a new mission, and paying off some of those debts, those college debts. A few years later, a change in policy with the second mission left us stranded in a high cost of living area, far away from any family this time, and again, without enough money to pay rent, and we had to move out of our apartment, and this time it was friends that came to our rescue. I can't remember how long it was, somewhat short of a year. The Mills and the Noltes and the Powells and the Cavins and the Apples and the Duncans and the Vanderveens took turns hosting us in their homes. And you know what? During that year, we paid off all of our student loans. We got out of bondage. These brothers and sisters in Christ, and as well as others I didn't name, pitched in to redeem us in a very real way. Christian health care, need sharing, is another way that this happens today. You can sign on with groups like Christian Care MediShare, or the Christian Brotherhood newsletter, or the Samaritan Ministries newsletter, and redeem a Christian brother or sister from the bondage of debt to a hospital for a medical procedure. They can in turn do the same for you if you don't have insurance. Here's some ideas. Helping people get out of debt. Do you know of anyone who is staggering under a burden of debt that you could help, that you could redeem? The third tool that I see in this toolbox here of Leviticus 25 for addressing the needs of the poor is retain. I had to find an R-E word. We might use the word sustain or support more naturally there. In verse 35, we see some people just need to be supported. They may or may not have the cleverness and fortitude to provide for themselves very well. They need help in order to keep living and to keep living with you and not be sold off on the slave market or carted into slavery somewhere else. What the rest of us are called to do is to relieve, help, sustain, or literally strengthen, add strength to him or her. And this hadn't changed in the New Testament. We see in Galatians 2:10, remember the poor. Galatians 6:2, bear one another's burdens. 1 Timothy 5, honor widows who are widows indeed by providing income for them out of the church treasury. If they're qualified, 1 Timothy 5 goes through that. Here, I see three ways that the poor can be supported, sustained. First, by keeping fair prices for the commodities that you sell them. Verse 36 talks about not exacting interest or usury from them. And verse 37 says, if you're selling food, don't gouge them with prices they can't afford to pay. The object in verses 35 and 36 is to keep him living next to you, not shuffling him off to the low-income section of town so you don't have to see him anymore. Keep him next to you. Why? Verse 38 gives the reason. Because of who the Lord is. He's your God. Generous sustenance of a fellow believer brings us into conformity with the character and habits of God. God strengthens weak people. God delivered Hebrew slaves out of Egypt. God delivered Jewish exiles out of Babylon. Isaiah 41, he says, but you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my loved one, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its furthest corner, saying to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you off. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. When we strengthen and uphold and sustain someone else, we are entering into the kind of thing God himself does. That's his character. Secondly, we can retain the poor through charitable donations. Notice Leviticus 25 encourages this kind of sustenance to be done privately, though. It doesn't say if you have a widow, tell them to apply for Social Security. Or if you have a poor mother, tell her to apply for WIC. Or if you have poor people, tell them to apply for welfare. If you have chronically ill people, tell them to apply for Medicaid. There's no mention of impersonal or government-run charity in this in the Bible. Only of private charity, where you reach out to help a needy person that you know personally. Now, I'm not saying that we should go on a crusade to eliminate all the government support systems in our nation right now. But what we can do as a church is look for ways that we can provide personal, relationship-based assistance to needy people. And, the people to whom God brings to your attention, people who are by you, near you. As we model that ideal of the superiority of relationship-based, private support for the poor, the world is going to see the superior results. And maybe then the bigger systems will change in time. But private friendship and accountability is very important in meeting the needs of the financially destitute. I get people call our church phone number frequently asking for money. And I don't think I've ever gotten a phone call from a church member asking for money. It's always people who have no relationship with the church that are calling. And as I've invested time in talking with some of them, 99% of them are having these problems because they have no accountable relationships. They have no web of support. They have left everything. They've left all the people, all left their family. In most cases, they could connect with family and friends, but they don't want to. They don't want accountability. And then, of course, I start talking with them about where do you go to church? Can I call your church pastor? Oh, no. No need for that. Or, we want to build relationships with you. Would you consider coming to our church? Oh, well, no need for that. They'll hang up politely and end the call. Or maybe they'll impolitely yell at me because I won't give them money. But how are ways that we can connect personally with needy people? One of the models that I have seen was started just a year or two ago over at First United Methodist. The Circles program. What they do is they gather a group of successful people, business people, whatever, in a group around one needy person and say, okay, you meet once a week. And as they meet once a week, relationships develop, and the people with means start seeing needs and they start personally helping. And I think that, and then there's accountability because you're meeting every week with these people that are helping you. And I think that's a good model. And we do that to some extent. We've been doing that to some extent in our own church, just on a smaller scale, for the almost the whole life of our church. And this can also be scaled out larger, on an international scale. The green prayer letter on that back on the bulletin board back there is from the Five Loaves Ministry that spun off last year from the Tentmaker Project. They give money to First Presbyterian Church of Kampala, Uganda. That church building, across the street from it, is a slum. I've seen it myself. It's a kind of place where people live in cardboard boxes and are trying to survive from one day to the next. Many of them selling their bodies in order to do that. A recent drought there in Uganda has left people in desperate circumstances hunting for rats to eat. So this ministry sends $500 a month to Pastor Patrick Bukenya there at the church, and he uses that money to buy food and to hire some of the needy people in his own church to cook the food and provide free dinners at the church building for these people from the slum next door. And they do come. I've seen them come. And they hear a gospel message after the dinner. And some of them have begun to regularly attend worship churches, worship services, even when there isn't a meal served, as a result of this ministry. A third way that I see of sustaining the poor, in addition to donations and fair trade, is employment. If they lost their business or assets, they can work for you in exchange for a decent wage. And I believe that's the spirit behind verses 39 and following of this chapter. Depending on the version you're looking at, there's the word slave or servant appear here. But the word servant has a much wider range of meaning in Hebrew than it does in English. And in Hebrew, it includes the concept of work relationships that we might call an internship, and it includes the concept of employment as well, or what we would call employment. Just as the sale of land was really about the sale of potential harvests, as we talked about last week in the biblical economy, so the sale of persons was not really about the sale of the soul, but about selling the labor of that person, the potential labor of that person, for a contracted amount of time. When a person in this biblical economy sold themselves, what they were selling was the number of years of work that they could provide and getting basically paid up front for that. They were not sold as chattel, as things. Verse 42 says, the slaves, even slaves, still belong to God as a person, that God has personally delivered out of Egypt. And that's repeated again for emphasis in the last verse of the chapter, verse 55. The children of Israel belong to me as servants. They are my servants, those whom I delivered out of the land of Egypt. So they're fully persons, not two-thirds of a person or whatever. Verse 40 says that any person living among God's people who sold his labor and became a servant had to be treated in the same way as any other hired worker. Piecing together what it says in verses 39 and 41, he might have to live in his new master's house and live by the rules of that new master's household, but he or she could not be treated as though they were subhuman physical property. Verse 43 talks about not pushing them ruthlessly to the breaking point like the Egyptians did with Egyptian slavery to the Hebrews. That time in the master's house then was to be a time of discipleship, training in the successful business principles that the master had figured out, training in God's ways, so that in the year of Jubilee, that slave could go out of the master's house together with his family, ready to succeed in life with a second chance. And according to other parts of the law, we see the master is also supposed to give him seed money for getting restarted as well. This kind of slavery, as you can see, is more like what we call a business internship. Just getting somebody prepared in order to succeed in a business on their own. There's a lot more in this chapter. And there is a different kind of slavery that's mentioned right after in the late 40s. What is this about slavery of foreigners? What is this about Levites? How does that apply to us? What's this thing about houses in walled cities versus houses in suburbs? What are our personal responsibilities regarding debt? There's a lot of things that I haven't gotten into yet, a lot of things that I haven't even figured out yet, and I'm going to keep studying for the next week. But for now, we have these three biblical tools for approaching poverty. Reset by forgiving a debt. Redeeming by paying to get somebody out of a debt or helping them get means of production back. Or retaining, just giving free support and keeping them living next to us with charity. As we've thought through these things, does anybody come to mind that needs to be redeemed out of a bad situation? Does anybody come to mind that needs long-term support or that has a debt that you need to forgive? Your response to that is a function of what you believe God to be. If you believe God is one who gives second chances rather than clobbering you the first time you do something wrong, if you believe God redeems people, is willing to get himself messy with sinful people who fail and lift them out of the messes that they have made by their own evilness, if you believe that God supports and gives generously to his people to keep them sustained, then you will start acting like that God that you believe in. And that is the power, and I believe that is a key difference. And I mentioned kind of it's often been the liberal churches that have lost sight of the gospel of God's forgiveness through the redemption that Jesus Christ made for us. It's often the liberal churches that have been the most enthusiastic about helping with poverty. But for them, they have bought into a humanistic reason for it, that I want to do what's good. I want to earn brownie points. I want to feel good about myself, and that's why I'm going to help poor people. The biblical motivation for this, and it's a powerful one, is if I believe God has saved me, has redeemed me through Jesus' death on the cross, his life given for mine, if I believe that he has given me a second chance to walk in relationship with him, and that God sustains me in that relationship, then I have that. That is the powerful motivation that I can do that in a way imitating the God that I serve with brothers and sisters. And that's the motivation that I want to encourage you all to find and practice.